at a Lipschitz point, and this is based on four papers which appeared on the archives in the last 5 months, 6 months or so.
I can give you the archive numbers, but since I started 7 minutes too late, and let's skip the numbers, I can give them to you privately if you want to. And also on some small amount of unpublished work done with my student Charles Melby Thompson at Berkeley. So I'll start with the motivation. Let's see, maybe I can schedule off the talk here. I'll try to motivate why I'm interested in this, and then I'll give an introduction into some methods that I'll be using, which involve condensed matter tricks, and I'll illustrate things by talking about the so-called Lipschitz scalar field theory, which is a beautiful non-relativistic QFT with lots of intriguing features, which we'll then want to mimic for gravity. And first I'll talk about gravity in 2+1 dimensions with a fancy critical exponent known as the dynamic critical exponent. I'll explain what that means later, equal to 2. Then I'll move on to gravity in 3+1 dimensions, which requires z equal to 3, and could be potentially a renormalizable, by power counting at least, quantum theory of gravity in 4 spacetime dimensions. I'll also talk in these two parts about infrared limits. So we'll also include infrared limits, deformations of the theories, such that in the infrared you reproduce more or less interesting physics. If we have time, which I doubt, we can also talk about other things like 4+1 dimensions, which might be more relevant in ADS-CFT correspondence if you're interested in reproducing four-dimensional field theories on the boundary, and you might pick various values of z, for example, z equal to 4, and then I'll give applications, several types of applications, if there is time. Okay, so part one, what is my motivation here? We have a leading theory of quantum gravity in the form of string theory. But string theory, in some sense, even though it's so powerful, and I like it, I'm a string theorist, by definition, I still think string theory is too large in some sense. Well, we're finding out, perhaps, that it's too large because it contains a huge landscape of vacua. It might be interesting to do all kinds of statistical analysis of the landscape, but you would hope that in order to address some really fascinating fundamental questions about quantum gravity, it would be kind of sad if we had to solve the entire problem of statistics on the landscape. Statistics on the landscape before we can address questions about black holes and even how to even make gravity compatible with quantum mechanics. You can always resort to some kind of an effective field theory approach, which is, of course, a legitimate starting point, but you would still want to eventually have some self-contained, smaller, so it makes sense to look for a smaller theory of quantum gravity, which would not contain all string theory. And the example I have in mind is Young-Mills, where we know that Young-Mills is fundamentally of interest because it's experimentally important. And you want to understand Young-Mills, you can embed it into string theory, and it's a very powerful way of solving at least, let's say, some versions of Young-Mills with various degrees of supersymmetry and various matter fields. You can use string theory as an engineering technique, how to learn about the dynamics of Young-Mills, but you don't need Young-Mills. You don't need string theory to show that Young-Mills exists as a self-contained quantum field theory. So I'm hoping that perhaps with gravity it might still be like that also, that we don't need to embed quantum gravity in some big framework of string theory, that perhaps there might be a way of decoupling it with from the rest of stringy degrees of freedom. And one lesson that I want to take from string theory, I'm looking for loopholes in the earlier attempts of people who were trying to find some such
decoupled theory of quantum gravity, perhaps in some path integral quantum field theory language in, let's say, 3+1 dimensions. And of course, they were not too successful. So there must be some loopholes we have to explore. We have to take advantage of. One loophole that I want to take advantage of is that in string theory, we've learned over the years that quantum mechanics wins in the battle between quantum mechanics and general relativity, attempts to reconcile those two structures. You could put your bets on either side of this. Perhaps one of them is more fundamental than the other. And of course, we still don't have the absolute conclusive statement, but in string theory, it seems that quantum mechanics is fundamental and general relativity is only approximate. First of all, we know how to generate corrections to Einstein's GR in string theory systematically. We also seem to believe in string theory. People often say that space, or sometimes even space-time, is emergent. So that's another lesson. And when you take these lessons together, string theory seems to indicate that it doesn't make too much sense to assume that the conventional space-time symmetry, such as Lorentz invariance, so the point is that we should question Lorentz invariance as a fundamental symmetry. It's difficult for me to imagine that in a theory which predicts that the space itself is emergent, in that theory, Lorentz invariance should somehow be postulated to be a fundamental symmetry of nature. That doesn't seem to be too logical to me. So I'm happy to give up on Lorentz invariance, and that's going to be the main loophole I'll try to explore. So I want to look for a path integral definition, a path integral defined version of quantum gravity. Without fundamental Lorentz invariance. Eventually, we'll try to see if we can perhaps restore Lorentz invariance or backgrounds which are close to Lorentz invariant in the infrared. So this brings us again to the idea of emergent infrared symmetries in the RG sense of the word. Perhaps Lorentz symmetry can be expected to be an emergent IR symmetry. This type of behavior happens all the time. So the method that I'll be using to build some such theory without relativistic invariance is I'll borrow techniques from condensed matter. And in condensed matter, this type of thing, where you get a system which is fundamentally non-relativistic, but it exhibits an effective emergent Lorentz invariant behavior at low energies, that actually happens all the time. So in condensed matter, this happens all the time, or much of the time, maybe not all the time. And some examples of this, of course, spontaneous symmetry breaking, and if you have Goldstone fields, generically, you expect them to have some kind of a relativistic effective dispersion relation. Another example is Fermi liquids. If you have a 1+1 dimensional Fermi liquid, then if you, from the RG point of view, zoom in on the lower energy excitations, they reside near the Fermi points. And their dispersion relation, even though you start with the dispersion relation, where relation between omega and k is the usual non-relativistic one. Once you fill in the ground state, you get a Fermi surface or Fermi point in 1+1 dimensions. The low energy dispersion relation becomes a linear, or in other words, relativistic dispersion relation with some emergent, well, just say this, with some emergent speed of light. And of course, the theory fundamentally has no built-in Lorentz invariance yet. At low energies, you would see an emergent approximate Lorentz symmetry. If you are in deep plus-1 dimensions, then this behavior does not happen in conventional non-interacting or weakly interacting Fermi liquids. But if you have Fermi points, if you have strongly interacting fermions which have a dimension 1,
sorry, a dimension zero point on the Fermi surface, depends on whether you want to be in this momentum frequency space. But in any case, I had a paper 5 years ago or so in PRL on K-theory and Fermi liquids, where you can actually see that in theories which have Fermi points, the dispersion relation near a Fermi point is guaranteed to be of the relativistic form, with the corresponding Yellow matrix is automatically coming out of the K-theory construction as a result of the so-called Atiyah-Bott-Shapiro construction of K-theory. I'm mentioning this here only as an example. I'll show you yet another example, which is the Lipschitz scalar systems, which are generalizing the idea of the Lipschitz scalar. They also, as we will see, are happy to exhibit an emergent Lorentz invariance in the infrared. All right, so this is my motivation, and also it might be interesting to see what kind of practical reasons we might have for looking for this type of a generalized theory of gravity which has no Lorentz invariance built in. What would you do with this type of theory if you can write it down? And there are at least three or four different types of applications. First, of course, we might be still interested in reproducing gravity in our universe. But of course, the jury is still out. It's very early in the development of these theories, so I cannot conclusively claim whether or not any of these types of models have anything to do with the conventional GR in the infrared. There are various hints that interesting things happen, but lots and lots of calculations will have to be done before this gets sorted out. But I would like to say that even if it turns out, for example, that we are not lucky in this class of theories, and they have nothing to do with observable gravity in our universe, there are still at least three different types of applications that you might keep in mind for these types of models. One of them is ABS-CFT, where the logic is you're not necessarily interested in the gravity theory for ABS-CFT in order to understand gravity. You're interested in gravity as a dual description of some field theory of interest. So here, we don't care whether that corresponding gravity theory, whatever the dual is of your field theory, whether or not it satisfies any of the classic tests of GR, because there is no Mercury perihelion test in 4 plus 1 dimensions, for example. So as long as the gravity theory is a consistent theory of gravity, if it describes the dual picture for some interesting field theory, then it might be interesting to consider it, even if it has nothing to do with the gravity in our own universe. And in particular, I want to say that, well, this is something I should mention in some prominent form. In particular, condensed matter ideas that I'm interested in, that I'll be borrowing for my construction, they have to do with what they call an isotropic scaling, where they say in condensed matter, when you're interested, let's say, in some randomization group fixed points under some uniform rescaling of space, there's really no reason in condensed matter to assume that time would scale the same way, and therefore they introduce the so-called dynamical critical exponent, or little z, so this is what's called the dynamical critical exponent, measures the anisotropy between space and time. And it's the same z that I'm referring to here. So when you have theories which have this type of anisotropic scaling, you can, if you are a high-energy theorist, you can ask all kinds of interesting questions that we know and love in the RG analysis of field theories with relativistic symmetry. You can ask them for theories which have this anisotropic scaling. So you can pick your favorite value of z. If, for example, the theory is Lorentz invariant, then automatically, by the symmetry, there's a non-normalization theory which tells you that z has to be equal to 1. If the theory is Galilean invariant in the conventional sense, so it's a non-relativistic theory but with an extra set of Bose transformations of symmetries, z would be equal to 2. An example of a system like that would be the Schrödinger equation, the action that gives you the free Schrödinger non-relativistic equation. So if I had some complex field psi, I can postulate an action which starts off as so. Perhaps there are some interaction terms. And clearly you see that z is equal to 2 because 1 spatial dimension, one time dimension is scaling the same way as two spatial dimensions. Throughout the talk, I'm using the I index for spatial dimensions. So I goes from 1 to D in general, in D spatial dimensions. And I always use this non-relativistic set of conventions. So this is the purely spatial Laplacian, and you see that Z is equal to 2. But there are systems which have all kinds of other values of Z. For example, you can have fractional values of Z. Z equal to 3/2, famously, is the value of the dynamical critical exponent for the Gardar-Parisi-Zhang equation that describes surface growth in non-equilibrium dynamics. So all kinds of interesting values can happen in quantum matter and do happen. And you can ask, how would the conventional quantum field theory be generalized to situations with this anisotropic scaling? In particular, you can imagine some such theory with Z not equal to 1 as your conformal field theory, and you can ask, what is the natural set of gravity duals? Sometimes you might be lucky, and the gravity dual might be a conventional GR in some fancy non-trivial background, but in general, it would seem natural to expect that just as much as you allow anisotropic scaling properties in the boundary theory, perhaps it would be natural to allow them also in the bulk. So that it represents another motivation for developing this program as hypothetical duals of interest in condensed matter field theories. And motivation number 3 would be, I'm certainly willing to learn the lessons from string theory that the string worksheet is a quantum gravity system, two-dimensional gravity coupled to two-dimensional matter. So gravity can appear on word volumes of brains. So if I can develop some new theory of gravity, perhaps with anisotropic scaling, then one can consider putting that type of gravity on a brain and see if we can make sense of some perturbation theory analogous to string perturbation theory. Or at first, if we can make sense of the first quantized system of brains with that particular dimension. And in particular, the case of 2 plus 1 dimensional membrane word volumes is of interest because this could be relevant to M theory. M theory is still somewhat mysterious. We don't understand the fundamental degrees of freedom properly. So anything that we can learn about how to define path integrals for 2 plus 1 dimensional brains what might be useful. And of course, finally, the mathematical applications of path integrals to things like topological invariance. So even if you build a theory which ends up, for example, being a topological version of quantum gravity, it might still be interesting. And I'll argue that the class of theories that I'll be developing now is actually quite closely related to the theory of the Ricci flow equations, and that in turn is related to the proof of the Poincaré conjecture. So if you're looking for a natural quantum field theory whose path integral might be calculating invariants relevant to the Poincaré conjecture problem, this seems to be the natural class of models to consider. Okay, any questions about the motivation? So I'll start with the Lipschitz scalar, which is the simplest theory with anisotropic scaling outside of the confines of simple Galilean invariant theory. It's a theory which is not going to be Galilean invariant, even though it's going to be described by a very simple Lagrangian. And it's also a theory which has lots of condensed matter applications and lots of generalizations in condensed matter. But none of them involves gravity, so the next step will then be, we'll try to generalize the theory to the gravity context. In the Lipschitz scalar theory, I can just write down the Lagrangian in D plus 1 dimensions. With those coordinates, but I'll actually try to motivate this instead of just postulating the action and then it would come from nowhere. I'll motivate it in a way which is similar to what people do in condensed matter. We'll start with a relativistic scalar in D spacetime dimensions, and we are Euclidenizing the path integral. So this is a theory described by some d-dimensional action, which I'll call W, because I'll be reserving capital S for the action in d plus 1 dimensions of the actual Lipschitz scalar. So this is an auxiliary theory in d dimensions. You may want to think of one of these dimensions here as the weak rotated time if you are thinking of a conventional
relativistic field theory, but I won't microrotate any of these dimensions at any point to the real time. I will instead add an extra time dimension. So I'll start with the simplest theory in these dimensions, which is just the free scalar field. And this free scalar field, of course, is a beautiful theory, because if you look at the dimension, the engineering dimension of the field phi, then I can never do dimensional analysis in my feet, but this apparently is the minus 2 over 2. So, of course, famously, this is dimensionless in two Euclidean dimensions and explains why string theory is so unique, because precisely when d is equal to 2, this theory will develop an infinite number of classically marginal couplings. In other words, any metric on the target manifold will represent an infinite sequence of coupling constants. And famously, the beta function vanishing gives you Einstein's equations plus systematic corrections, as Friedan showed some 35 years ago. No, 25 years ago? 1985? So 25, 30 years ago in Berkeley as a student. Anyway, so that's a very beautiful system. It's deceptively simple, but it has an interesting critical behavior, critical in the sense that d equal to 2 is the lower critical dimension of the system. And to a condensed matter theorist, this Euclidean theory might be the Hamiltonian of some static universality class of some critical behavior. And they might be asking a dynamical question. They say, I'm done observing all the static critical properties of my sample. I want to turn on dynamics and see what happens when time evolves. So presumably my static universality class splits into a bunch of possible different dynamical classes. And how do I understand the critical behavior in the presence of this extra time dimension? So they developed the notion of detailed balance. This is a trick. They basically postulate that they are interested in a theory in d plus 1 dimensions, which is not just some arbitrary theory, but a theory which is closely related to the theory in d dimensions that we started with. In particular, if you define the partition function of this theory using the path integral, you're integrating over phi, you're integrating e to the minus w. They are basically interested in reproducing the partition function of the d-dimensional theory through some kind of a ground state of the theory in d plus one dimensions. So they postulate, they're looking for a theory which satisfies the detailed balance condition, which you can read as an assumption that the theory in d plus one dimensions will have a Schrödinger ground state wave function. So you can think of this as a function of now the spatial values of phi. So x now will be the space of the space-time of d plus one dimensions. And they postulate that psi is effectively given by the square root of the density of the path integral here. In other words, the partition function reemerges as sort of an unnormalized square of the ground state wave function of the d-dimensional theory. Can you find a theory which would have this type of a guaranteed ground state wave function solution? And the reason why you want that is that you're basically constructing a theory in d plus one dimensions which still has the static partition function of the d-dimensional theory as a solution, because you are just taking that static system out of equilibrium. That's roughly the logic as I understand it. And beautifully, the answer to the question, how do I construct this type of theory starting from the Lipschitz scalar, from the relativistic scalar, is the Lipschitz scalar theory. So this is going to be, perhaps I should write down the action in a more prominent location here. So I now have a theory in d plus 1, and I claim that that solves the problem that I just set up for the relativistic scalar. This is a theory in d plus 1 dimensions. And so phi is now a function of space and time. So I'll have a kinetic term which is going to be, let me put a half in front of the whole thing, phi dot square minus, and then I'll take, for reasons which will become obvious in a second, I'll take this type of a spatial part of the kinetic term. But as I,
Sorry, I might have missed something, but you were talking about treating this as an equilibrium static thing. If I think of equilibrium, don't I have to have interactions? Otherwise, if I'm just dealing with a free theory like
you can,
isn't everything equilibrium?
I'm studying the Gaussian fixed point as a reference point.
Yes.
You can imagine turning on interactions,
so everything would
get dots, but I don't want to make the story too complicated. But everything that I'll be trying to do today is essentially doing physics near a Gaussian fixed point, the novelty being that some of these Gaussian fixed points will have the anisotropic scaling built in. All right, so this is now the Lipschitz scalar field theory action. And we can convince ourselves that it solves the problem that I set up. First of all, let me point out that this is indeed a theory with z equal to 2. Because again, we have the spatial Laplacian here making its appearance. So you have four spatial derivatives and two time derivatives on the same footing. And you're defining the fixed point in such a way that they are normalized to a constant with respect to each other. In fact, you can generalize this constant to an arbitrary coupling that survives at the Gaussian fixed point. You can have a coupling constant E, and then the dispersion relation would be at omega squares to k to the fourth. And E parametrizes, if you really want to overdo it a little bit, then you could say E is an exactly marginal parameter at the Gaussian line of at the line of Gaussian fixed points. But it can be absorbed into the rescaling of time versus space, so in that sense it's not really a very interesting parameter or relevant, sorry, marginal coupling constant. So first of all, why would this solve the problem that I set up? The reason is that if you quantize this theory in the Hamiltonian formalism, the Hamiltonian is going to be something like Q dagger Q up to some uninteresting normalization, normal ordering constant, where Q is, let me get the signs correct. So I'm quantizing this in the Schrödinger sense, replacing the momenta with d by d phi, and let me restore E equal to 1 for simplicity. Q is this, so because the Hamiltonian has this factorization property that it is essentially a square of something. If you find eigenvalues of Q, eigenstates of Q with zero eigenvalue, then those will be automatically the lowest energy eigenstates of the full theory. So you've reduced the problem of solving a more complicated equation of motion to the first order in the variation. And you can easily see why e to the minus w hat is precisely annihilated by Q, because this momentum operator, when you apply it on to the exponential, will just pull down the variation of the action. In other words, the left-hand side of the d-dimensional equation of motion. But that, by design, is precisely the same thing that I put in by hand here. So this gets to be minus 1/2 Laplace of phi, and gets offset precisely by that other thing. So that explains why I picked the action to be of this form. This is essentially the square of the variation of W with respect to the field. And then you can technically rephrase what you mean by the detailed balance condition at the level of the D plus 1 action. You say the action satisfies detailed balance if it has this type of special form related to an action in D dimensions. All right, so hopefully I've convinced you that this system now, the Lipschitz scalar, is the solution to this particular problem. We can also ask, what are some, irrespective of any relationship to D dimensions, what are some other properties of this Lipschitz scalar theory? Maybe I'll skip that because that's mostly relevant to condensed matter, with the exception of one or two small comments. First of all, this is a Gaussian theory, it's exactly solvable, it's a free field theory, nothing fancy at all. And you can ask, what are the relevant deformations? So you can think of this as a UV fixed point. Imagine a free scalar field theory, which is in the UV defined by this type of behavior. And you can ask, what are the relevant deformations of the fixed point? They will flow you somewhere in the infrared, and you can ask, what is the generic thing that I get in the infrared theory? And the nice feature about this Gaussian theory is that you can study the flow while being Gaussian throughout the whole thing. It's kind of cute that the relevant terms you can turn on R, of course, you can restore VI phi squared with some dimensionful coupling. I should say I'm using conventions where I'm defining dimensions in the units of the spatial momenta, somewhat mimicking the relativistic notation in high-energy physics. So in this case, the dimension of T is going to be -2. So this mu is of dimension 1. It's a relevant coupling constant. And of course, you can also turn on some kind of a mass term. So there will be two possible relevant Gaussian deprivations of the theory. And if you turn on this one, let me start with the sign being -1. I've set E equal to 1 for simplicity. So if I start with this choice of the sign, then it turns out that in the infrared, and let's turn off the mass for now. Let's tune that to 0 and see what happens in the infrared. In the infrared, what happens is that this term wants to combine with this term to give you the infrared kinetic term. And you see several consequences that in the infrared, the theory falls to z equal to 1. You can ask, wouldn't that get spoiled by turning on the rest of the relevant deformations? But of course, the answer is no, because this guy, you can turn it on. It's even more relevant than this spatial derivative piece. But it's not going to flow you further from z equal to 1. It maintains the z equal to 1 as the generic scaling. That's a good thing here in this type of theories. They do want to become, if not relativistic, at least they want to flow to the same value of z, which is mandated for Lorentz invariant theories. That doesn't mean that the theory will be Lorentz invariant, but in this case, it actually accidentally is Lorentz invariant, because you just see a Lorentz invariant emergent kinetic term. And the speed of light here, the effective speed of light in the infrared, is also emergent, and it's set by the values of these relevant coupling constants. In particular, what you want to do in order to make the relativistic symmetry more manifest, you want to redefine the new time coordinate, let's call it x0, to be c times t. And then again, c, as you see, has to be proportional to mu, which makes sense dimensionally, because if t is of dimension -2, c has to be of dimension 1 in order to give you the relativistic time dimension of dimension -1 in dimension counting. So what we usually think of as the speed of light and set equal to 1 is secretly, in this type of theories, coming from a dimension-full relevant coupling constant of the anisotropic UV theory. This is also, by the way, how Lipschitz in 1941 postulated this type of theories, because he was interested, for him, in order to get what he was doing, he would have to rotate T to the imaginary time and think of all these as various spatial dimensions. But modulo that subtlety or different interpretation, what he was interested in was a multicritical behavior. Instead of tuning higher and higher terms into potential to 0, instead of fine-tuning to get to higher critical points, he was saying, why not tune the coefficient in front of the spatial part of the conventional kinetic term to 0 and see what happens? We get a multicritical point, which is now dominated by the next higher dimensional piece in derivatives, and if you are on either one or the other side of the fine-tuning, then you get either the conventional relativistic-like phase, or if you have the wrong side here, then you would get a spatially modulated phase. So his tricritical point is connecting three different phases. The conventional homogeneous phase without a condensate, the conventional homogeneous phase with a condensate, and the third phase would be the spatially modulated phase. Okay, enough about the scalar field. I want to do the same now for gravity and see if we can come up with a simple construction of some interesting Lagrangians of gravity systems with anisotropic scaling. So I'm now going to basically do steps 3 and 4 in one, because the theories really don't differ formally from each other that much. The idea now is starting in D plus 1 dimensions. I was originally interested at first in 2 plus 1 dimensions, because you could say, if you are a string theorist and somebody shows you the Lipschitz scalar, then you can naturally ask, if I can find a theory in 2 plus 1 dimensions, which is associated with the with the relativistic scalar field in 2 dimensions in this unique way, can I extend that to the full Polyakov path integral where I have the same scalar field coupled now to 2-dimensional gravity? So for that, you need some version of z equal to 2 gravity in 2 plus 1-dimensional membrane wall volumes. Now let's do it in d plus 1 and see what happens. So the fields will be, at first I'll start with postulating the minimalistic set of fields in d plus 1 dimensions. I'll just take the spatial components of the metric. So far, there is no full decomposition of the space-time metric, but later I'll add to this fields like the lats and shift variables of the ADM decomposition. So even though this is not going to be a relativistic theory in the UV, you'll still want to start with a set of fields which kind of remind you of conventional general relativity in the Hamiltonian formalism. I'll be using the same notation as in the ABM picture. And let's just postulate right away an action in d plus 1 dimensions. It's going to be, again, this volume element, depending on the value of z, which I haven't specified yet, this is going to be of dimension minus d minus z. And since the metric is naturally dimensionless, this will also determine the dimension of the gravitational coupling constant. This is sort of the analog of the Newton constant for this kind of theory. And I postulate a theory which will have two time derivatives in the Lagrangian, because I don't want to get into issues with non-unitarity of the Gaussian fluctuations near the fixed point. So I don't want higher derivatives. I need some kind of a covariant object to sum the indices against. So this capital G is going to be the so-called DeWitt metric. And it turns out that the most general DeWitt metric compatible with my symmetries here is going to be of this form, where lambda is an arbitrary coupling constant. So this is a dimensional coupling which survives already at the Gaussian fixed point, so it will show up in the dispersion relations of some of the excitations of the system. But it's a coupling constant which in principle will change with the scale. If you want to write down the quantum theory path integral for this, then lambda wants to run and will want to know where lambda goes under the normalization group flow. For GR, lambda would be forced to be equal to 1 by full space-time diffeomorphisms. But here it's actually not forced, it's not constrained to be anything, because the gauge symmetries of the theory so far are the following. There is a preferred foliation of space-time by fixed time slices. And so far, I have a theory where the only symmetries that are manifested in the action naively are spatial diffeomorphisms, but they're not even allowed to be space-time dependent. And I don't like that. I want to covariantize this theory later by adding these lats and shift variables, in which case, once we do that, as a preview of what happens, it turns out that you'll have a gauge symmetry which consists of all foliation-preserving diffeomorphisms. So this is a preferred foliation by time slices. The full symmetry group that preserves these slices consists of these symmetries, and those will be the symmetries of the full theory, and they will still allow lambda to be an arbitrary coupling constant. Now, this is the first step of the construction and kind of mimics the phi dot squared piece in the Lipschitz scalar action. Now you want to add the term that mimics the variation of W with respect to the scalar field. So here we'll have the variation of some d-dimensional action with respect to the metric squared. I'm being schematic here, but the square is again with respect to the inverse of the same DeWitt metric that I used here. So this is a theory which is designed to satisfy, again, some kind of a detailed balance condition. I didn't have to postulate the action in this form. I could just say, let me pick a value of z, let's say z equal to 2 or z equal to 3, and let's write down, given the dimensions of fields, the most general Lagrangian that satisfies some symmetry, let's say the foliation preserving diffeomorphisms. And if you do that, that's certainly a conservative starting point. It makes a lot of sense to do that.
But then you end up with lots of possible terms which are of the same dimension. Even if you are keeping track, as I'm now here, only of the hypothetical terms of the same dimension in the UV as this leading kinetic term. In other words, only if I'm only listing marginal terms in the action near the Gaussian fixed point, you might still have like 10 different coupling constants. And that sounds prohibitively complicated. So I want to cut down on the number of independent couplings. And that's why I postulate this detailed balanced form of the action. And in condensed matter, whenever you do that, it actually turns out, strangely enough, this was somewhat against my high energy intuition, but it turns out that this restricted form of the action is actually self-contained under renormalization. You don't generate counterterms which would not be of this form if you postulate that your theory starts by satisfying the detailed balance. So in other words, you inherit the renormalization group properties from the theory in D dimensions, and you just have to do one more renormalization, which is essentially the relative normalization of these two terms. That's the only extra term you have to calculate. So the theory becomes much simpler in terms of the quantum mechanical behavior, and that at least is true of the pre-gravitational theories with detailed balance. I don't have a calculation that shows whether this holds for the system with diffeomorphism invariant or not. So that's a hope at the moment.
Is there an understanding? Is there some enhanced symmetry that it has?
That's an excellent question, and I guess the best answer to that, as far as I can see, is that you can rewrite that theory using an auxiliary supersymmetry. If it satisfies the detailed balance condition, then there's this thing that people call sometimes the Parisi-Sulla supersymmetry or the Parisi-Sulla supersymmetry of stochastic quantization. This is very similar to if you weak rotate time to the Euclidean, time dimension, then this same logic would apply to the so-called stochastic quantization of quantum field relativistic quantum field theories. So in that case, if you, for example, stochastically quantize the Yang-Mills, you get a theory which formally looks like a 4 plus 1 dimensional theory in some extra time with z equal to 2, and that isn't a theory which would become more complicated with more generic 5-dimensional counterterms. Instead, you get counterterms that look like those coming from 4 dimensions plus the renormalization of the extra time. And again, it's because formally this can be rewritten by integrating in a bunch of fermions and finding out that this theory exhibits some accidental-looking Parisi-Sulla supersymmetry, which then restricts the form of the counterterms. But again, for the gravity case, I don't have such a rewriting. We haven't really tried to use the supersymmetric formalism for this. I should warn you again, that supersymmetry has nothing to do with physical supersymmetry. It doesn't add like fermion superpartners to things. It's just a formal. Once you rewrite this using some auxiliary field, and then you integrate in a 1 written as the path integral over some auxiliary fermions, then it turns out that action in the end happens to exhibit this non-relativistic version of supersymmetry. All right, so now we can start with examples. Oh, first of all, I should say how to covariantize this. It's easy to reproduce the theory when you have the full diffeomorphism, foliation-preserving symmetry by, so the covariantization, I in fact missed the volume element, of course. So the covariantization would insert 1 over n here, and then we would replace, whenever there is a g dot, we want to replace g dot with the extrinsic curvature of the slices of constant time, which is this object. I actually didn't realize for a while that this was the extrinsic curvature. I was just doing this by brute force by trying to look for invariants, and this came out as the only invariant. And then you look it up in Stephen's book or somewhere, and it turns out that this is the extrinsic curvature of the foliation. And that's it. That's the whole covariantization. The whole rest of the action is going to be invariant under these foliation-preserving diffeomorphisms. You could now generate different theories by dialing values of z. You can start, for example, with z equal to 2, the first non-trivial action. By the way, I should say, this could have been done for Yang-Mills. In fact, for Yang-Mills, I tried to do this in the first paper of the 4 that I was mentioning at the beginning of the talk. And strangely enough, it is kind of a curiosity that even 4-dimensional relativistic Yang-Mills satisfies detailed balance. If you think about it, it satisfies detailed balance with respect to the 3-dimensional Chern-Simons action. You can rewrite in a formal non-relativistic way, a conventional altruistic gang mills in such a form that this is basically the variation of the 3D consignments with respect to the gauge field that gives you the magnetic part of the action, and the theory has z equal to 1. Here we start with the simplest example, which has z equal to 2, and obviously in the UV, we want to postulate the three-dimensional action to be the simplest or the only and unique action of gravity with two derivatives. So I'm just taking the scalar curvature. Again, this is the scalar curvature in D dimensions. You take this, you plug it in into here, and what you get is the simplest version of a theory, which has a z equal to 2 hypothetically Gaussian fixed point in UV. There is, of course, some kind of a coupling constant, which I'm for now setting equal to 1. So what you get here is the left-hand side of Einstein's equations squared. And you can unpack this, and it will give you terms like RRJ with some coefficient, plus the term that goes like R squared, and that's it. You can look at the dimension of the coupling constant in front of the action, and it turns out that the coupling is dimensionless in 2 plus 1 dimensions. So we see the similar shift in the critical dimension of the system in which the coupling is dimensionless, and you can have formally renormalizability perhaps by power counting, at least if you have enough terms in the action that this is self-contained under renormalization. But by power counting, this theory will be renormalizable in 2 plus 1 dimensions, and that's just as well because, of course, string theorists in particular know very well that this object in 2 plus 1 dimensions is identically zero. This gravity theory will have as little dynamics in 2 plus 1 dimensions as conventional gravity has in 2 dimensions, and that's a good match because, if you remember, one of our motivations at the beginning was to see if we can design a 2 plus 1 anisotropic gravity theory which would be reproducing the Poiseuille path integral. So it's reassuring to see that the dynamics simplifies here. But maybe I should stay away from membrane applications and focus more on the physical applications. In higher dimensions, of course, this will be a coupling constant which has a dimension of some positive power of length, the length scale, and this is an effective theory in the same sense as conventional GR. And you can ask, what if I start deforming this theory by relevant deformations? Yeah.
So you know, this theory is has the same number of fields as GR. I mean, you have the ADM.
Oh, I should say,
just the same number of fields, but you have less gauge invariance.
That may or may not be true, depending on what. But I can do several things. I can say, for example, unfortunately, I erased the symmetries, but they include reparametrizations of time, which are only time dependent. In some sense, N is like a gauge field associated with the time reparametrizations. And it turns out you can consistently, the most conservative way is to declare that N is not allowed to be a function of space. So that's the generic assumption. If I don't impose any other symmetry, like a Weyl invariance or something, which is another fascinating topic which I'll probably be able to get into, then this is the conservative way of treating the theory. N is only a function of time. You look at this in the Gaussian approximation near the flat space, which is a solution. So the solution would be N equal to 1, Ni equal to 0, and Gij equal to delta ij. And then you can linearize the theory, look at the dispersion relation, and it turns out that you get, let's do this only in 3 plus 1 dimensions. It's generally true in any dimension. In 3 plus 1, you would get two transverse traceless graviton polarizations whose dispersion relation is omega squared equal to k squared to the third. And then you get one scalar. This corresponds to precisely the number of symmetries and the number of fields that you have. And so the symmetries are all given by first-class constraints in the Hamiltonian formalism. It predicts the right spectrum consisting of two gapless gravitons. By gapless, I mean that there could have been a constant here, but that constant is automatically zero. And the scalar will have a dispersion relation, which now has a number here, which depends on lambda. And it depends on lambda in an interesting way. If you plot the dispersion relation versus lambda, and there are three special values of lambda. That's 1 over d, or if I'm in three dimensions, then 1/3. This is what corresponds to the conformal
value of lambda, conformal theory. Lambda equal to 1 is also special, because this number here is actually proportional, if I make it more explicit, some pure number times, I guess, lambda minus 1 over 1 minus d lambda. Oh, with a minus sign? Anyway. Let me put an absolute value here. No, that wouldn't be. I'm trying to reproduce this on my feet, but the idea is up to a sign. This gives the right dispersion relation. So this is not a tachyon or a ghost on this side. So this shaded region is the allowed region where the spectrum is ghost-free and tachyon-free. For the intermediate range, the third, by the way, the third special value of lambda is infinity. And in this range, you would have ghosts. So this scalar mode wants to be a ghost. There are never any tachyons in the spectrum, but this wants to be a ghost in this forbidden region. So I would try to stay away from there. I would start a theory somewhere outside where the spectrum is perturbatively looking unitary, and then you have to flow this under the RG anyway and see where lambda wants to go. Maybe it wants to go to 1, or maybe it wants to go to infinity. I doubt that it would want to cross this physical region, so that's roughly speaking what I can tell you about the spectrum. I can try to artificially declare n to be a function of spacetime, and in that case the constraint algebra becomes a nightmare, and it's unclear whether one can consistently quantize the theory with n being a function of space and time while getting local degrees of freedom. There's a consistent way apparently of quantizing that theory as a topological theory, but that could be of no interest, perhaps, to realistic for the application.
If n is an ordinary function, I mean, that is formally equivalent to the thing that we studied, Gauss condensation. So then you have an extra scalar degree of freedom.
In the Gauss condensation theory, you start with a relativistic theory to begin
with,
right?
I mean, I'm just talking about the degree of freedom counting. So
okay.
Maybe we shouldn't go into that. But let me go back and ask you about your thing. I mean, so now n of t, you've gotten the number of degrees of freedom,
uh-huh,
right, by making basically, you know, you have less gauge freedom, so you had essentially eliminate n as a degree of freedom by fiat by making it a function of
time.
Well,
you don't eliminate it necessarily, because you didn't have a theory where n was a function of space and time to begin with.
Okay. Okay,
consistently
let me
just ask
my question. And my question, though, is just n is a function of time only. Now
right.
This theory is not manifestly local.
That's
so
correct.
So what do you know about that aspect of this theory with n as a function of time?
That's a good question. These are things that happen in condensed matter systems, and I'm just learning about this as I go, because, of course, you have so much intuition based on the conventional local relativistic quantum field theory.
But
so
now this is some very fundamental sort of non-locality, or looks like some fundamental non-locality, right, in the UV.
Well, you have a corresponding constraint that you get from the constraint algebra, which is, again, non-local. You get an integral of the Wheeler de Witt Hamiltonian over all space. I'm happy to return to this point, but I still wanted to at least move on to two things, which is, so I'm hoping to discuss this at the end of the talk or afterwards. I need to do at least two more things, one of them being a relevant affirmation of this theory. From the UV point of view, you can ask what are relevant affirmations, and you can again answer that at several different levels of attack. You can say, let me just add dimension-full couplings compatible with symmetries directly at the level of the full action, or you can say, let me try to maintain the detailed balance condition and let's modify, instead of the d plus one dimensional action, let's modify the d dimensional action. And if you do the second way, of more restricted way of deforming this theory by relevant deformations, then of course there is a unique deformation by the cosmological constant in the d dimensional theory. If you do that, of course this modifies what's getting squared here to the left hand side of Einstein's equations with the cosmological constant. And again, when you unpack what happens, you get here a generic scalar term and a generic thing that I would call an infected cosmological constant. And then by inspection, of course, again, these two terms will be the ones which are analogous to the spatial kinetic term of the scalar. If you remember how we were deforming the Lipschitz scalar, it was
the mass term and the spatial derivative, lowest spatial derivative term that dominated in the infrared. The same happens here. And then you look up the structure of conventional general relativity in the ADM formalism, and you find out that it takes exactly this form, that the Einstein-Hilbert action in the ADM formalism up to total derivatives look exactly like this. It's the d-dimensional or three-dimensional, if you are in four dimensions, scalar plus a constant, plus this particular combination of the extrinsic curvatures with, however, of course, lambda is restricted to be equal to 1. And potentially there's that extra difference that we were talking about earlier, namely n, of course, in GR is a full function of space-time and the theory is fully diffeomorphism invariant. So here, the potential discrepancies in the infrared compared to GR, first of all, the theory wants to be z equal to 1 in the infrared, so that's a success. At least it flows you to the right value of z. But if you look at the discrepancies, and perhaps lambda may not end up being equal to 1, which is one infrared discrepancy. And of course, we have a mismatch in the number of fields compared to GR, which is, again, mimicked by the mismatch of the number of gauge symmetries per spacetime point in GR. So there are certainly differences compared to conventional GR, unless you can promote this field N to something which has space-time dependence, and that's very much a work in progress on several levels, so I'm not going to talk about that at all. I also wanted to mention there is at least one...
Sorry, even if you have N as a function of T, you have an additional scalar in addition to the spin two modes? Is that
of course. But then, of course, if you, for example, manage to formulate the theory with an extra... space-time gauge symmetry per space-time point. If you get one more symmetry than what we started with, then that would match the number of degrees of freedom in GR. But that's an open question. I can comment on that, but I have nothing really coherent to say at this point. Other than the following, there is a way in which you can actually, or you're forced to promote n to a function of space-time, which is most relevant to 2 plus 1 dimensions. And this is... relevant to the case of this type of theory with an additional local conformal symmetry. If you recall the Polyakov path integral, of course, we have a two-dimensional theory which is quantum mechanically conformally invariant. You want to do the same in 2 plus 1 dimensions, but you have this embarrassing fact that the scaling is anisotropic, so there is no way of having a conventional Weyl invariance in the theory because of the anisotropy. However, you can define, as it turns out, anisotropic Weyl transformations. And in general, they'll take n, transform it to e to the z times an arbitrary space-time function over 2 times n, and it'll transform gij into e to the omega of xt times gij, and the same for n, sorry, for ni. So you see that this forces n to be a space-time function. And in fact, as it turns out, you can consistently, in 2 plus 1 dimensions, at the classical level for sure, formulate a theory which has this type of symmetry. And if you couple it to Lipschitz scalars, which are massless scalars, then that sector will also share the same local anisotropic Weyl symmetry. So there is at least that particular mechanism for allowing n to be a function of space-time. Of course, that requires, in the quantum theory, that the theory does not break conformal invariance quantum mechanically, and that's, of course, a rare situation, just like in string theory, that would pick out the critical dimension of string theory and decouple the Liouville mode. I don't expect too many interesting 3 plus 1 dimensional theories, for example, to have this Weyl invariance as a quantum symmetry, just like you don't expect too many gravity theories with conformal invariance to survive quantum corrections. So finally, since I have, at least by the Berkeley time, 5 minutes left, let me move on to the case of z equal to 3. So this case of z equal to 2 was at least power counting renormalizable if you involve all possible terms of the right dimension in 2 plus 1 dimensions. If you want to do this in 3 plus 1 dimensions and get something power counting renormalizable, then of course you need the time derivative to be worth three spatial derivatives. In other words, we need a three-dimensional starting point action which will be varying and squaring here to be such that it gives an equation of motion which is of third order in derivatives. And there is actually, strangely enough, a beautiful and unique candidate for such an action. You would think at first it's very difficult to get equations of motion which would be of third order in derivatives, because usually you start with an nth order action, you get two nth order equations of motion. But precisely when you are in three dimensions, you can get the so-called Coffman tensor at the left-hand side of the equation of motion from varying and Lagrangian. What is the Coffman tensor? The Coffman tensor is a very important geometric object which is specific to three dimensions. It's defined through the epsilon tensor in three dimensions. And it has many specific geometric as well as physical properties. First of all, it's symmetric and traceless and transverse, as one can check, even though that's not explicit from here. It also follows from the variation of an action, which is just the Chern-Simons action, where you treat the Christoffel symbol as a functional of the metric. You vary the metric in this action, you get the Coffman tensor vanishing as equations of motion. And also, this tensor is sometimes in the GR literature called the Coffman-York tensor, because it's very important in GR. In geometry in general, this is very important, because in three dimensions, famously, the Weyl tensor is identically zero. And if you recall how the Weyl tensor vanishing is the condition of conformal flatness in dimensions higher than three, you can ask, what is the condition of conformal flatness in three dimensions? If the Weyl tensor is identically zero, it has to be some other tensor vanishing. And it's the Coffman tensor that takes over as the condition of conformal flatness. In GR, it's important because it's very closely related to the initial value problem. If you look at the 3 plus 1 decomposition of GR, ask what is the freely specifiable set of variables at the initial surface, which part of the metric and the conjugate momentum can I specify without violating the constraints, it's actually related to the structure of the Coffman tensor. Last week I got an email from Stanley Deser, who says this should properly be called the ADM Coffman-York tensor, because apparently they had the same idea in their 1962 paper, the ADM paper, that the initial value problem is associated with the Coffman tensor. But anyway, the idea now is to get a theory which in the UV is dominated by the square root of the Coffman tensor. This has equal to 3, and here you just get a slightly different UV structure. But you can again deform this theory by adding relevant deformations to the three-dimensional Chern-Simons action. In particular, you can add the Einstein-Hilbert term and the cosmological constant. You would be getting, by the way, very close to an action of topologically massive gravity, except for one subtlety, which has to do with the reality conditions here, because I'm thinking of this as a Euclidean three-dimensional action. I'm not recrotating this to 2 plus 1 dimension, so I might have a different convention for the reality property of the Chern-Simons coupling. But other than that, this looks very much like topologically massive gravity. You stick this back into the action, you get deformations, which again, in the infrared will spit out the usual decomposition of the conventional Einstein-Hilbert term. So again, you get very close to conventional GR modulo these discrepancies that I keep mentioning. So I'm not claiming that this is giving you GR on the nose. There are all these differences, but you get at least the relativistic value of z equal to 1 without any work as the generic property of the infrared flow. So in that sense, it's already an interesting set of ideas. So applications, you can try to see whether there are interesting ADS-CFD-like solutions. So I'll leave that for private discussions. We have some results. Some of them were actually in one of the papers. In particular, let me mention just one. There's a very simple and interesting solution of this class of theories. Whenever you start with W, and this is insensitive to the precise value of Z, whenever you start with an action W in D dimensions, where I'm only imposing one condition, let's assume that it has a Euclidean ADS as a solution. That's not a very restrictive condition. And it turns out that there's going to be a solution which looks like Euclidean ADS in D dimensions, static in time. So the spatial metric is just Euclidean ADS, and n is equal to 1, and ni is equal to 0. This is always the solution of that type of theory, or more precisely, this is the solution of the theory in D plus 1 dimensions, which used the D-dimensional action
with an IDS as a solution, as a source in this sense of these digital balance conditions. This is a very interesting geometry, a very interesting solution, because it has a boundary which is the B minus one dimensional sphere across time, and if you think of what kind of conformal symmetries you get induced on that boundary from the isometries of the bulk, you get precisely the conformal transformations of the sphere plus time translations. And those are precisely the symmetries you expect if you had a condensed matter system which is already conformal or critical spatially at a static level, and then allow it to evolve with time. These would be the conformal symmetries that you expect from that type of a system. So this is a candidate, at least at this crude level, of having the right solution. This class of models could be candidates for describing ADS CFT rules of non-utilistic critical systems. So my final application is, if you have a theory which can be defined through some kind of a path integral, what can you do with it? You can put it on a lattice. And I believe that's actually exactly what already happened in the work of Ambjorn and his group, mostly Jurkiewicz and Lowe, other collaborators as well. They had an interesting breakthrough in lattice gravity in 3 plus 1 dimensions. They've been trying to push the two-dimensional triangulation approach to 2 plus 1 dimensions and 3 plus 1 dimensions. And if you try to look at triangulations in two dimensions, famously, this is the way you can get matrix models of string theory, and you produce a two-dimensional sum over surfaces of quantum gravity. That makes sense. You've known that for 25 years or so, or 20 years. And what if you try to do this in higher dimensions? Well, you're out of luck, because generically, I'm told, what people are getting for these triangulations is that the low-energy limit, the long-distance limit of the theory, does not even give you the right space-time dimension. Instead, you get a branched polymer phase of these triangulations, something which has a fractional effective dimension of space-time. So they were able to fix that problem by imposing in their triangulations, they're imposing a preferred space-time foliation. So they sum over triangulations like this, where there's some preferred foliation imposed on the triangles. But this is, of course, generalized to higher dimensions. So they're allowing arbitrary triangulations. They have some prescription for how to associate particular weights. And for the first time in the history of lattice gravity, they were actually able to measure the dimension in the infrared and get four space-time dimensions if they start with 3 plus 1 dimensional triangles. So what is it that they put in that changes the universality class from the branch polymer to this nice four-dimensional limit? It's actually the preferred foliation, which is exactly the symmetry structure that I'm putting in the continuum framework. They actually can measure more than just this so-called spectral dimension of space-time. They define the spectral dimension by putting some kind of a diffusion process on the triangulation and then averaging over triangulations. And they see in the lattice simulation, as a function of the proper time of the diffusion process, they see that asymptotically the spectral dimension really approaches 4 with a good precision. Now, at short distances, they have some lattice artifacts that don't make any coherent sense. But that they also have an intermediate state. They can actually see that in some weird way, the effective space-time dimension extrapolates from 4 in the UV. So they claim we get 4 in the infrared, and effectively 2 in the UV. There is an effective dimensional reduction. Then more precisely, they claim that measured value, the lattice value, is 1.8 plus minus 0.25, which is compatible with 2. Now, they interpreted, I'm almost done, so I'm just wrapping up here. The idea is they originally were surprised by this. They were saying, yes, we are getting a beautiful, smooth four-dimensional space-time, obviously, at long distances, even though we cannot look at, they haven't really been looking, for example, at fluctuations in the geology. They can't tell you what kind of spectrum this theory would have. This is way too much to ask at this stage. But at least the correct dimension of space-time is reassuring. But they were saying, perhaps what happens at short distances is that what looks like a nice, smooth, macroscopic four-dimensional space-time develops some kind of a foam structure. Perhaps it's a collection of interconnected two spheres. And that explains why we see this dimensional reduction of the dimension down to 2.
I have an alternative explanation, because you can define the same spectral dimension object. This is a mathematically well-defined thing, which I can define on any geometry, in particular on a spacetime with some anisotropic scaling with some value of z. And you can evaluate this by studying the diffusion process on your space with the right degree of anisotropy. And you get that the spectral dimension is equal to 1 plus d over z. So if you now imagine starting with z equal to 3 in 3 plus 1 dimensions in the UV and flowing to z equal 1 in the IR, then the spectral dimension in the continuum framework indeed interpolates between 2 and 4. So this was one of the reasons why I actually flew to Denmark last week, and we talked with Jan and Bjorn. I can't speak for him, but I think we are both enthusiastic about this possible interpretation of the results, that they might be actually looking at a simulation where they allow precisely for enough arbitrariness at the level of the lattice action that the way in which they have to tune the coefficients to get a continuum limit zooms in on some kind of an anisotropic UV fixed point. And then that flows automatically to z equal to 1 in the infrared and reproduces, therefore, dimensional microscopic spacetime. So perhaps that's a sort of experimental result related to these anisotropic continuum theories. And that's all I have to say for today. Thank you. So one question was about the non-locality and n being constrained to be a function of only time. Perhaps we can return to that if there are no other questions. One comment I have on that is that you can always try to either go to a gauge for the, I mean, n being a function of time is not such a huge number of degrees of freedom at the level of fields in the theory, in this theory. And you can just say, for starters, let me just set n equal to 1 either as a gauge choice that precisely fixes those time reparametrization symmetries, or let me just not even impose time reparametrizations as a symmetry to begin with. And in that gauge, everything will look nice and local. So I don't think it's necessarily a big issue that the action formally looks non-local because of one field not being allowed to be a space-dependent function.
But then you have the other, that's right. So but then you have the other scalar, right, in that theory. So that thing isn't going to have, it's not going to describe ordinary GR. It might describe some other consistent theory. Right.
Sure.
Some sort of scalar tensor.
And again, for starters, I would be more than happy to have a theory which is potentially a renormalizable theory which involves a spin 2 gapless or perhaps massless in the infrared field, even if it gets coupled to some extra stuff and doesn't reproduce precisely on the nose the physics of the universe I know it in 3 plus 1 dimensions. I think we shouldn't be overly ambitious and try to just get everything in one step. Having something path integral defined and at least having a shot at being a renormalizable path integral definition of some theory with a spin 2 particle seems like an interesting starting point to me. And I'm happy with that, so.
So you should have then one sort of overall conserved charge from that.
If you don't impose the, I mean, if you don't allow time reparametrization symmetries. Yeah, that would be the eigenvalue of the naive Hamiltonian would be an extra conserved quantity which would not be constrained to be zero by some analog of the Wheeler derivative equation. And again, it sounds exotic, but on the other hand, we all know how difficult it has been in the history of GR to try to reconcile the concept of time in conventional GR with the concept of time in quantum mechanics. So looking for some more exotic ways of reconciling those concepts. Something has to give. It's going to be either something on the GR side or something on the quantum mechanics side. And in string theory, we know, again, the lesson is that we haven't touched quantum mechanics at all. We're just using the same rules of quantum mechanics as always, but we are modifying general relativity in principle as a consequence of that. So I would still
try to maintain the same notion of the time dependence in quantum mechanics, where there's some kind of a Schrodinger equation, and give up the conventional notion of time and see what, on the GR side, and see what that where that leads us.
Another question, the form that you use where you have this sort of pre-potential-ish form for the action,
right.
Is your sense that that's really just a technical simplification, or is your sense that that's somehow fundamental to this kind of construction?
That's an excellent question. I think about this from several different points of view. For me, so far, it's been only a technical trick, trying to reduce the number of independent couplings. But I suspect because this is so closely connected to the ideas of taking equilibrium systems out of equilibrium in condensed matter, we haven't really addressed, especially in string theory, in my opinion, we haven't addressed the issue of what happens when you take gravitational systems, perhaps string theory states, out of equilibrium, or maybe only now we're starting to learn things about string theory out of equilibrium. So I wouldn't be surprised if there's actually some physics conceptual reason why this class of theories might be in some sense special, because they might be actually addressing some physics question we haven't asked yet about how you take gravity out of equilibrium. But for now, that's just a dream. I don't really have any substantial evidence that should be happening. So I'm really using it as a purely technical constraint to simplify the starting point of the analysis. And I haven't shown even that this is self-contained under normalization in any sense. But in non-gravitational examples, that was a good strategy to use. So I'm trying to follow in the same footsteps in the gravity situation as well.
And is the message that you know that, so one of these gravity theories, let's say 3+1 dimensions.
Okay,
whether or not, I don't care whether or not it's GR, right? But I care whether it, do you know that it, to what extent do you know that it doesn't have any sort of pathologies? So you said that it doesn't have ghosts, doesn't have tachyons. Does that mean that you are convinced that, for example, the Z=3 theory in 3+1 dimensions is a completely consistent theory?
I'm not convinced at all. I'm just saying that there are first signs, and I haven't seen any obstacles against that happening, but I don't have any conclusive.
I mean, what I mean by inconsistent, let's say I'm even more modest, I say low energy inconsistency. So in other words, even if it's not UV complete, I can treat it as some sort of an effective theory, but I just want to know that it's a self-consistent theory that contains massless spin 2 at low energies.
Right.
That you feel that that is established?
I think it has a shot. I don't think it has been established by any stretch so far.
Well,
what
still would need to be checked to establish that?
Well, you just sit down and develop the usual. I mean, this is a path integral. This is the starting point of a path integral formulation. So you'll really want to actually explore this in some particular gauge. You want to develop some kind of a BRSD quantization and see the same things that you would do for Yang-Mills. If somebody writes down the Yang-Mills action and
perturbative quantization of the fluctuations
Haven't
done.
So that's the starting point, and that hasn't been done yet.
Okay.
I mean, it sounds conceptually straightforward once you've settled on some set of symmetries and some particular Lagrangian. But of course, this is a nasty theory technically, because it's a theory with a very nonlinear Lagrangian and of tremendously high ordering derivatives. If you, for example, are interested in 3+1 that is equal to 3, you will have 6 derivatives in the spatial directions in the starting point of your action. And you don't want to pick a gauge fixing condition that spoils that necessarily. If, for example, you wanted to try and prove that this is in some sense perturbatively renormalizable, then you don't want to ruin that by a bad gauge choice. So perhaps you want to pick a higher derivative gauge fixing condition, and it just becomes very technical very quickly. So nobody has calculated even a one loop running of any couplings or anything. This is just the setup, the classical setup that looks like by the naive assumption that you can calculate near the Gaussian fixed point at least has the right ingredients to have a chance to be power counting normalizable, and the calculation needs to be done, hasn't been done.
Classically, it's not obvious that it has a well-defined initial value problem.
I think it does have it should have a well-defined initial value problem in the same sense as any other action which is of second order in time derivatives. Because You don't change, for example, unlike things like the higher derivative relativistic gravity theories, the kinetic term is essentially modulo that extra parameter little lambda. This is more or less like a conventional GR kinetic term. It's just that you change the spatial dynamics, but not necessarily the time dynamics. I'm not saying I've proven anything conclusively, but
the thing I'm worried about is that in GR, the proof that the initial value problem works really depends on a finite speed of light. It's sort of a finite fixed speed of light, so that you can say that some region at some slightly later time than your initial surface is determined by the initial data in some finite domain on your initial surface. Is that true here? I mean, how do things propagate?
They would follow it, again, to the extent that you can stay within some hypothetical free-field fixed point, you'll follow a dispersion relation which is dominated by these higher power terms. Let's say we are in z equal to 3. You'll just have a dispersion relation which will have all kinds of powers between the one dominant in the UV. And of course, if you are sufficiently highly energetic, then you can propagate sufficiently fast, arbitrarily fast, because the actual velocity is unbounded by the effective speed of light. But the important thing is that scale is essentially comparable to the Planck scale. So you have to be, if you are a super Planckian particle, then you might be propagating effectively faster than the speed of light.
Uh-huh.
But low energy particles obey the usual speed of light condition with a very good accuracy, because they
dominate.
I mean, they're dominated by the relativistic dispersion relation. But I don't know how that influences the initial. Nothing has been proven conclusively.
Right.
I'm just saying this is a classical theory which has interesting properties, and you might consider it a good starting point to develop the usual perturbative quantum field theory expansions with this action. And whether or not at some point we'll hit obstacles that, I mean, nobody has proven, for example, that there is a positive energy theorem. That's another thing you want to worry about, for example, compared to GR. Is there a ground state which has an energy boundary from below, or could you have negative energy solutions? For that, at the classical level, it actually, again, turns out that for some window of the parameter lambda, you actually can show that the Hamiltonian is positive, manifestly positive definite, unlike in GR, where we know that, of course, that's formally not true. You have to work hard to actually prove that there's a positive energy theorem. It just doesn't fall from inspection from some obvious structure of the Hamiltonian. Here, in this class of theories, sometimes it falls just straightforwardly from inspection. Looking at the Hamiltonian, you see that it's positive definite, but sometimes it doesn't, and then it's an interesting question. In that window where it's not manifestly positive definite, what are the conditions that are giving you a positive energy theorem that hasn't been analyzed either? There's only so much you can do with it within some finite amount of time. The foliation is, you can see that from several different points of view. I'm seeing the foliation as a part of the data before you even start writing down, even before you say what kind of fields you have on your space-time, you say a part of my differentiable structure of the manifold is the structure of a foliation. So that's a notion from differential geometry. People in differential geometry have developed the theory of foliations, general foliated differential manifolds, and of course that doesn't require any prior structure. You don't need a metric or anything else to define the foliation. It's there as a prior piece of data of the differential geometry, and then you put some kind of a quantum field theory on top of that foliation and pick your symmetries to respect those foliations. My kind of dream scenario here is, of course, what I've shown you today is some kind of a phenomenological bottom-up approach. You just start from scratch and try to build this theory. Another approach you might take, if these theories exist as consistent quantum theories, then it might be actually possible to engineer them directly from string theory. You pick some fancy background, maybe there's some kind of a field which picks out the preferred foliation of space-time because it has a VEV of a certain type, this would be somewhat like the gauss condensation story, except covariantized to the full string theory, where you would be really starting with some consistent string vacuum, which would be believed to be UV complete by itself, and you would be taking some kind of a scaling limit on top of that background, and the scaling limit might involve building this preferred foliation out of some condensate of some field. Perhaps if you take away in that scaling limit the fluctuations associated with that field, you might end up with something which contains only gravity fluctuations, or maybe a gravity coupled to some bunch of fields on top of this foliation. Again, this is a dream. I don't have any realization.
This might be very fancy, very far off, but if you imagine this having something like this coupled to matter fields, there's no reason why the matter fields would have the same speed of light as gravity. So
yeah,
it's hard to imagine how, you know, black hole thermodynamics would make sense.
Well, the thing is that...
No, I'm absolutely with you. That's one reason why I didn't include the coupling to matter here. Because if you really want... I mean, you can couple this to matter at various levels. For example, if you have that theory in 2+1 dimensions with the extra Weyl invariance, turns out that Weyl invariance helps you with the coupling to matter. You can couple to matter consistently. You don't run into issues like this, that every species of a theory, which species that don't get mixed by some extra symmetry would want to have arbitrary speeds of light with respect to each other. There's nothing that locks them all together. You can say, maybe I can super-symmetrize everything and put everybody in the same super-multiplet. Maybe some super-symmetric version of this might have the same uniform speed of light for all species. But who knows? But so this is something that I'm happy to just say this is a theory of pure spin 2 plus perhaps that scalar field. And already those two guys don't have the same dispersion relation with respect to each other. You have to look for other ways in which you want to, if you want to really turn this into some semi-realistic theory. I'm very far from that at this point, of course. But if your ambition is to see if this can be turned into a model for the actual physics universe that as we know it, then you have to come up with a mechanism that locks all these different, potentially different speeds of light to have the same value. And I have no idea. I mean, we have some speculations what type of tricks you can try. Engineering this from string theory would actually be one possible scenario, because then we know that there are various types of space-times with anisotropic scaling that might force the same speed of light on several species because it's embedded in some bigger relativistic environment. But again, that's not a part of what we've established so far.
Thank you.